This is WJBC This Week.
It's not implausible. In fact, it's a modest suggestion that, you know, actually we could have some new revenues in year three or four that actually positively affect our general fund.
This is more about sending a love and pray to the people of Nepal.
Council says, well, Mr. Snow's just chipping away, but that's all he can do because of the number of people here.
So really, Martinez's testimony really wasn't worth a whole lot. And it was actually Carlos Luna who did identify the defendant.
Difficult negotiations in government often involve political theater. That's a little bit of what that is.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Bloomington's mayor outlines his vision for downtown redevelopment and how he wants to make it happen. A new agriculture project gets off the ground, or in the ground, in Normal this weekend. We'll explain what this food forest will do. A local doctor responds to a study which says some vitamins can increase your cancer risk. A local soccer league looks for new places to play once its field goes away. Plus, a Hall of Fame broadcaster remembers where it all started here in Bloomington. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner has plenty of ideas for what the downtown redevelopment plan might include and how to make it happen, but he says there's one thing it won't be. Renner says the city wants to help facilitate the proposed demolition of four buildings, but isn't getting into the property management business. He talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
You're talking about the demolition of some buildings downtown, really not knowing what at this point is going to go in there. I mean, ultimately, you'd like to see a hotel.
Well, it's actually the original project, just to clarify, was not just a hotel. It was a hotel, conference center, light retail, perhaps a steakhouse. So there would be a mix of things.
And well, you've got a lot of ideas, right. but you have no takers now.
Because there are a lot of reasons. Buying land and redeveloping a downtown is not like a strip mall. A strip mall, you don't have issues of control of a land. Like Hy-Vee came in. Oh, that's the building I want. Downtown redevelopment in the United States and in most places throughout the world is complicated to revitalize because you sometimes have 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 people who own the properties.
Well, I think that's her critical point, though, because she brought up the Coachman, the hotel that was demolished.
Right.
And there were big plans. Somebody was going to move in there, maybe even a hotel, and it still sits there after all these years empty.
Right. Well, it's fundamentally different. First of all, it was also overly promised. it was part of a previous regime, the regime of Tom Hamilton. Things are much more open, transparent. We do not write contracts that don't protect the city anymore. We're riddled with dozens of contracts that didn't protect the city. And we're not going to make those kinds of mistakes in the past. The other thing is it's not the central property. This particular block would link the Coliseum to the central part of downtown. It has the front and center building is unfortunately something there's no way in the world you could save it. It's a hazard in downtown. And then two underperforming buildings. So it's very, very much a strategic block. And let me also clarify, the front and center building is a hazard, but it's not about to collapse. And unfortunately, as in the city, as long as there's not like broken windows or something that could hurt people who are walking by, there's not much we can do in code enforcement. And if we move, although if we do try to go to do battle with this owner, this landowner, he's pretty much legendary for making you spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in legal fees. And it's just a mess. So that really isn't, an option for us. It's certainly not a cost-effective option.
Does that mean the city of Bloomington needs a better or needs an abandoned building ordinance?
We need that. Plus, we also, frankly, we shed 100 staff people 5 years ago. We don't have the staff, frankly, to do what's necessary. Our code enforcement took massive hits. So, I mean, we're trying to get back up to speed. And actually, with Tom Daberreiner, we are way ahead of we were. I mean, when I first came in, there were almost on a weekly basis several problems with dilapidated buildings and whatever. Now, Tom Daberreiner's on that within 24 hours. It was just like pulling teeth trying to get our code enforcement to do their darn jobs. Now they're on top of things and proactive. But let me also just clarify one other thing that seems to be misunderstood. We are not talking about taking money out of the general fund to pay for the bond. the concept of a TIF is a conservative funding proposal coming out of the Reagan administration, where the Reagan administration said, don't expect grant money from the federal government for your downtown or urban renewal. Figure out a way, like a TIF, to make the project itself pay for itself by the fruits of the investment. So it's kind of what they call a but-for test. But for the private investment, you wouldn't be getting those extra revenues. Okay, right now, let's say roughly the building, a little less than that. The fair market value is a little less than $3 million for the area, right? And if it goes from $3 million to, let's say, $33 million, that's pretty much a ballpark. That $30 million increment, when the project's completed, will produce a significant amount of new property tax revenues. That money is set aside into a TIF, Tax Increment Finance District, and the TIF pays the bond, right? So if you negotiate so that the bond comes due when the project's complete, the TIF pays the bond. And actually, the if there are other things that we want, let's say there's a particular kind of proposal that we really want, we could even, at the second phase, throw in hotel motel tax fees for 5 years or something. Right now, we're getting nothing.
Okay.
Even homeless people won't live in that building.
What
right?
about so, the idea, this developer that right. Is offering to do all this work and then mm-hmm. sell it back to the city for 6 point?
Roughly 8.2, but
he's a smart guy. He's very successful. Why doesn't he just do it? I mean, if it were a slam dunk deal, you think he'd say, hey, look, I'll just take this.
Well, there are many reasons why city, and this is very common practice. This is what many of the things that were done in Normal or much more aggressive. Like Normal went beyond TIFs. They actually spent tens of millions of taxpayers' dollars revitalizing their uptown area. That's why in the scheme of things, we're talking about something that's far more conservative and restrained. We're talking about one piece at a time. This particular developer, if he did that, we would have no control over what he put in there. I don't want a Jiffy Lube there. Right. This is one of the ways that the city then gets control over the area. So we say, OK, you sell it back to us. And then we send out a request for proposals. We may not take what Gablehausen offers. So we might have a better, set of mixture of things. So let me also clarify, had we not got the money for the Route 66 Visitor Center one block away, that's in the first floor of the History Museum, that has had great success in opening 3 weeks ago. Had we not gotten that, we would have had no prayer at getting a project like this unless we did spend tens of millions of taxpayers' dollars. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about funding it by a TIF.
So Gablehausen will likely be one of the developers who will propose something.
Absolutely.
To the city, which the city could evaluate among other proposals.
Once the land is cleared, minus the People's State Bank building, it's shovel ready. At that point, we send out a request for proposals, even when that's imminent. And then we see, and frankly, since this has hit the papers, we've got many number of people from throughout the state and the Midwest.
And the
who
radio
are interested.
Airwaves.
And the radio airwaves. I'm sorry, and the radio airwaves.
Paper is a dirty five-letter word.
I see. Okay. And you're non-polluting.
So here's the other question, though. When you talk about the increase in the property tax value paying for the investment.
Correct.
What has happened to the city of Bloomington in the past is construction is delayed. I'm thinking of the TIF in Bao Chu, who was developing on the south side. That dragged on forever. Project wasn't finished. City wound up paying.
Unlike the past, when we write contracts, we're protecting the city. I mean, we can write a contract that says, you have to be in every morning at 7:30 in City Hall and eat cornflakes if we want.
Yeah.
And if you violate that, then the terms of the agreement require us to come forward. We want to make sure we have an aggressive timetable. And frankly, we've got a great model to the north. Normal took an area with vacant land, abandoned buildings, an EPA Superfund waste site, and turned it into an engine of economic growth. And we have actually, in many cases, better assets. If we do our job right, we don't have to spend tens of millions of taxpayers' dollars doing that. We can try to be much more conservative and do it on a piece-by-piece basis with, first of all, TIF funding, maybe some hotel motel tax rebates. It's not money we're getting in our general fund now because there is nothing on that site, especially the front and center. We're not getting any hotel motel taxes on that site. We're getting a little less than $3 million of fair market value property taxes on that, not $33 million or whatever you know it might be. So, again, it's that but-for test as we move forward.
That was Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner with Scott and Colleen. Bloomington Normal has its first food forest with its first planting this weekend. The University of Illinois Extension and Town of Normal have been working on the 1.4-acre project since last summer. U of I Extension educator Bill Davison joined WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Please explain, for those who don't understand what a food forest is, what that concept means.
A food forest is, in this case, it's an urban demonstration of an agricultural practice. It can be called agroforestry. That's what the USDA would call it. It's also a type of permaculture. And the University of Illinois is doing research with an academic term called woody perennial polyculture.
Oh, they always take the fun out of everything.
All names for the same thing.
Basically,
it's a diverse planting designed to produce food from perennial plants. So there's chestnut trees in there for the edible nuts, hazelnut shrubs, fruit trees of all sorts, apples, pears. There'll be more unusual things added into the mix, like persimmon and pawpaw. And then lots of berries, currants, raspberry, blackberry, all in the mix.
There's all from trees?
Trees and canes.
And bushes?
Shrubs, yeah. Trees and bushes, basically.
I thought it was building just higher structures to try and get some of your plants to rise up. So it's not. I thought you were just trying to get your plants, in some cases, to grow higher.
Well, that's part of it. So there's an arbor for grapevines, so they'll grow up and over the arbor. You can also plant grapevines at the base of a tree and let it grow up the tree. So it is about diversity, maximizing sunlight, capturing sunlight. And so there's lots of different ways to do it, but it is intended to be really diverse, complex, with a lot of different structures, and that makes it more resilient and resistant to pest and disease.
Are you creating, though, positivity in your space by creating shade? Are there foods that are best grown in also a shady environment? Because as you're trying to maximize the use of sun, if you have a more forested area, then you are also creating shade.
So this will evolve over time. It'll look different, you know, 10 years from now than it will initially. And there are plants that are adapted to shade. So there'll be lots of sun in the beginning. And then as time progresses and the trees grow, there'll be more shade. And so some things will come on over time and some will fade. And that's part of the evolution of the planting.
Now, the reason we're talking to you about food forests is because you're growing one. You're starting one.
That's
where,
right.
Where is that?
We're planting it at One Normal Plaza in North Normal off of Beach Street. And the site has a long history of housing children and having gardens and food production, and we're sort of continuing that legacy. We have an acre there that right now is grass, and it has all these crazy curved beds tilled up that we're filling up with thousands of plants.
What are some of the bigger trees and more unusual plants that are going to be going into your food forest?
So the larger trees are the fruit trees, and only some of them are the larger size. And those would be the apples and pears mostly. And then almost everything else is starting out rather small and inconspicuous as a little twig, but they should grow quickly because the soil there is really nice. It's actual topsoil, which I was glad to see because sometimes urban sites don't have that.
Yeah.
So it's
shocking,
really
shockingly
loose.
You're like, where did all that beautiful McLean County soil go?
Yeah.
I was told we had some beautiful soil here. How did it end up missing from this site? Now, when we're looking 10 years down the road and the food forest is producing abundance of beautiful fruits and vegetables coming from it, then who gets to harvest?
The food forest is open to the public. Anyone can come. And so I'm not sure what's going to happen, if it'll be picked clean or not at all, but we're going to do classes out there and bring school kids out, so I'm not worried. And my hope is that it is really popular. People learn to appreciate the food that it produces, and we will then demonstrate demand for the next one. So the long-term plan is to take over the whole metropolitan area with food forests.
That would be amazing if we could do that. Less mowing, more food production.
That was U of I Extension educator Bill Davison with our Susan Saunders. Young soccer players from across the Midwest are in Bloomington this weekend competing in an annual tournament. But if something isn't done in 2 years, the tournament might no longer be held in Bloomington Normal. The community fields in the east side of Bloomington will have to give up land to Central Illinois Regional Airport after 2017. Illinois Fusion Tournament Director Teresa Dubrovic and Director of Coaching Miran King talked with WJBC this week about what they'd like to see done to save the soccer fields for Bloomington Normal.
Has anything moved recently in the last year or two? I know there was talk last year about a local tax that would pay for use of a soccer field and a YMCA, something along those lines. Where do you see things standing at this point?
I think it's a concern. So if you talk about the economic impact of a tournament like this, if we had a better facility, we would be able to have even more than one tournament, I think, a year. The concern right now is that community fields will be closing. We will be able to have two more tournaments like this in May for 2016 and then 2017. After that, the facility will be closing. It will affect this tournament, but it will also affect where all these kids that are playing soccer. I know Myrne has probably a better idea on the number of kids in our community playing soccer right now. What do you think?
Sure. I think it, you know, is a big concern. I think that there's probably approximately 2,000 to 3,000 soccer players in our community, and that they're either registered or playing recreational soccer everywhere from Prairie City Soccer Leagues. I think we have around about 1,800 players. Illinois Fusion, who's the competitor, we have about 450. There's some other groups in town as well, and also the adult league as well. Yeah, there's a number of different adult leagues. So it's certainly a concern, because I think the model's being suggested that you go back to what you used to do in the 70s, and I think times have changed, you know, and it could be impossible.
What do you mean, go back to the 70s?
Well, from what I've heard, again, I'm relatively new to the area, that in the past that soccer used to be played in different parts of the community, on a little park, any green space that you can find. But that would be impossible to do now, just because the amount and the volume of players in some of those parks now are no longer there that used to be there. So certainly it's a concern. And I think that, you know, a complex where you can play can, you know, meet the needs of players in the community, but also, you know, it could also help bring in some economic impact in the community. Because I know we're always, you know, you want to do a better job of trying to bring revenue into our community so we can fix things and things like that.
How do you make this event happen without a place like Community Fields?
We cannot. It would not happen. There's no way. A facility, if we had a nice soccer complex, not only would it help with practices and the teams and the kids that are playing here, but the idea, our location is so ideal. You know, similar to the fact that our airport, you know, is centrally located. There's some very, very good clubs in the Chicago area and some very, very good soccer clubs in St. Louis. And they would like to meet here and play each other. They would really like to have a place here. This would be very accessible, Bloomington Normal would be, if they had some place to play. We have now where we will pay sometimes for field space, sometimes quite a lot, just to get to meet those teams in different types of tournament situations. Just to find a place to play is really very difficult.
So as it stands now, with just a couple years left and the clock ticking, what does Illinois Fusion plan to do? What can you do to try to precipitate something that will give you a place to play in 2 years?
I think talking to the community about the need is very important, impressing upon the, you know, the City Council of Bloomington and of Normal on the need and the demand for soccer facilities here in the area. It's becoming, you know, it's becoming more and more, you know, an important thing, because it's not like something that's just going to appear out of nowhere. We would need to build this type of complex. And we really do believe, even though it would cost money to build it, that it is something that would end up paying back to the community, that is something we could, you know, make money from, whether it's hosting tournaments or whether it's, you know, charging for the use of fields from other teams that are traveling.
That gets to one point that I sometimes hear from some who are hesitant about tax dollars going toward it. They'll say, well, the soccer families want the soccer complex. They can pay for it through user fees, registration, you name it. Is that practical? Is it feasible?
That's a good question. I think the hold up to this point has been the financing, and I completely understand that. I think that we're not only looking at the needs of the competitive soccer player, but there are many kids in our community as well that don't have the financial ability to be able to pay for soccer. And we provide scholarships and things like that. I think there are people with more knowledge of finance that are better, you know, who we'd love to get together to try and work out what's the best way to finance a project like this. So it could be beneficial, you know, not only just to say for the competitive club, but also for the wide spectrum of players from the scholarship kids the whole way through. So I think that would be a good starting point, you know, to have a conversation to see what is the best way to do it.
If I was going to add real quick, the other thing, you know, if you have no children or no soccer players in the area, this idea of having this many soccer players playing in every little park and every retention pond in your neighborhoods and fighting over that space, you know, I know I live in Bloomington, and it's not real desirable for me to have kids in every little nook and cranny fighting over space for practice or, you know, to field games. They would really be they would be overtaking the parks.
That was Teresa Dubrovic and Miren King of Illinois Fusion. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. A recent study in Britain says some vitamin supplements are doing you more harm than good. Bloomington surgeon John Whelan weighed in with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
Is it a credible study?
It actually is a credible study. There's several studies that over the last probably 7 to 10 years that have demonstrated a slightly increased risk with vitamin E. There was a prostate cancer study that was actually stopped because the statistics were not favorable. So they were asking men to take higher doses of vitamin E, and there was actually about a 13% increased risk of prostate cancer.
Wow.
During the study. So really, it's always hard to, these headlines always grab attention, and then you have to dig deeper into the nature of the methods and the specifics of the research itself, because oftentimes there's an association, and it may or may not have a direct relationship to the thing being studied.
Right, there are other factors.
Many other factors. Right? There were several other studies that there was a beta carotene study years ago that showed an increased risk of lung cancer actually in study participants, and it's really, I haven't seen that replicated, so I'm not really sure if that's legitimate. And you have to, when somebody says, well, there's a 13% increased risk of in this case, prostate cancer, you have to look at the absolute risk and the relative risk. So for prostate cancer, I think the numbers were 10.9 versus 9.3 cases of prostate cancer per 1,000 years, per 1,000 human years. So yes, that's a 13% increase, but it may not be really significant.
No, that does not seem statistically
right. But the headline. But if I'm writing a headline to call attention to my research, I'm going to say, "Hey, I'm going to play it up a little bit."
So, my question to you is: should people take a multivitamin?
Well, a multivitamin is not quite the same thing as some of these high-dose supplements. So, my answer to that, the simple answer is yes, if you're not eating an otherwise balanced diet.
Do you take a multivitamin?
I do not.
But he eats a balanced diet, probably.
What did you have this morning?
this morning I had some of that Kashi shredded wheat.
Okay.
I like that stuff. I know it's when you first eat it, it tastes like cardboard, but you get used to it.
Useless.
No, I like that kind of that shredded wheat. So I'm a cereal eater.
And that sustains you until lunch, and then you wolf down a double cheese pizza?
Yeah, and then it's chocolate chip cookies. No, but it actually does. I mean, it's very filling. So I like that.
A lot of fiber.
It is a lot of fiber.
All right.
But not everybody can. I mean, it's a balanced diet is more should contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, nutrients. And yet, I will often recommend multivitamins to my patients on the off chance that that they're not getting a completely balanced diet.
And then there are some medications that seem to interfere with, like, absorption of vitamins.
Well, they can with vitamins and then also other medications, too. So people have to be really careful when they're – anything that you take, you really need to study it a little bit.
Ask your doctor if it's right for you.
Yeah, ask your doctor.
Right, because there are interactions.
Or your pharmacist.
There are interactions. Right,
and sometimes we physicians, there are so many interactions with dietary things that we may not know completely what a patient is taking because a lot of us don't really consider those supplements as medicines. And they may not list them on an intake form or on a medication list at the doctor's office. So, and a lot of times the pharmacist can be very helpful in this regard too because they really have a command of the interactions of the drugs that they sell.
And I don't take any pills. I'm off my blood thinners, by the way. I don't take any. But when I was taking them, there, you can go to websites, we'll tell you.
Yes.
I mean, there are websites out there.
WebMD is
well,
a good one.
Blood thinners right? especially because there are vitamin K actually does interact.
Yeah, I couldn't. There was a lot of stuff I couldn't take with the blood thinner.
Right. And there's a lot of predominance of certain vitamins in foods that we eat, too. So some medications, that will affect the absorption of certain medications.
I had to lay off the spinach.
Yes. Spinach has high vitamin K. Yep. It's very good for you.
Yeah, but I couldn't take it when I was on my blood thinner.
Right. So in those cases, when you're limited, you just kind of have – if it's a short-term thing, you have to be – you just have to kind of have the self-discipline. But if it's a more of a chronic situation, really, then you need to work with your physician or perhaps a dietitian to kind of figure out how you can – compensate.
All right. So she asked you about multivitamins.
Yeah, multivitamins have
regular vitamins.
Well, multivitamins have sort of the recommended daily allowances of these various substances. So when we're talking about specific vitamin supplements, like vitamin E, vitamin C are the popular ones.
B12.
Yeah, those are really higher doses of those particular vitamins. And so In a multivitamin, those doses that they combine are much smaller, more of a dietary amount.
The B12 shots that you see a lot of times, celebrities,
rock stars,
you know,
right.
who are just exhausted, they're
right,
getting
right.
their B12 shots. Does that actually make a difference?
Well, if you have, there are a few rare conditions where that actually relate to having had a particular portion of the GI tract removed, where vitamin E absorption is critical. That if you don't have that portion of the intestine, then you actually would need vitamin B12 supplementation. But for the most part, it's readily available in many foods and even in a multivitamin. So no, I don't think the
no B12 shot. Kathleen, you think about it after a long weekend of working?
No, listen, it was interesting, though. I was feeling kind of run down, and I didn't really understand why. And I talked to my doctor, and he said, well, a lot of patients who take metformin see a drop in their B12.
Yes.
So I started taking a B12, you know, supplement, just, I think, 500 milligrams or something, and it really made a difference.
And again, that's one of those situations where the interaction is the culprit. So, yeah, it may be necessary, but in the person on the street that doesn't have any other competing...
The normal people, right?
Yeah, the normal people. Yeah, that doesn't have any competing pharmacology, theoretically they would not need that.
That was Dr. John Wieland with Scott and Colleen. Hall of Fame broadcaster Denny Matthews has been the voice of the Kansas City Royals
since the baseball team was founded in 1969. He's been behind the mic for some thrilling moments, some as recent as last year's World Series. The Bloomington native got his start at WJBC many years ago, and he returned to our airwaves this week as he joined our Brian Bloodworth.
Can you kind of give us an idea of how you got started at JBC?
Sure, Brian. It was while I was still in college at Illinois Wesleyan, and apparently somebody out on campus, and I think it was Jack Hornberger or maybe Don Larson or both, heard that I was somewhat interested in sports announcing, and so they told Don Newberg, who was the program director, news director at WJBC, and after my sophomore year of football, there was that gap between playing football and baseball in college. I didn't play basketball. And they asked me if I would like to help them do high school and college basketball in between seasons, which sounded like fun, and I think I got maybe $5 a game or something. Hey, but don't laugh. That's big money at that time, and when you're in college, you're looking for any loose change. So it was a great opportunity. It was terrific on-the-job training, and for my last 3 years at Wesleyan, I was able to do basketball in between playing football and baseball. So it was a wonderful opportunity, and it really was the launching pad for my career.
And you bounced around after JBC at a couple of spots, I know, but then you landed with the Royals, and you've been their only broadcaster, and now I'm a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I say it's the only real job I've ever had, the regular job. And the other jobs were maybe a little bit part-time, but nonetheless, they were very valuable to me, too. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of the Royals all through the years. And like everything else, you're going to have good years, bad years, and some in between. But the Royals were an expansion franchise in 1969, and they became a pretty good team and a viable contender in just 3 short years.
Getting back to your days at WJBC, the story I always heard was you were just kind of thrown on the air one night. Is that right?
Yeah, that was Don Newberg's deal. Took me out to a Bloomington High School game. I think they were playing Decatur. And we were sitting at the table, and Don was doing the play-by-play. I did the starting lineups, a little halftime interview, and then the totals at the end of the game. And I thought that's what I'd be doing that night. And so Don Newberg did the first quarter of the game, after which he jumped up real quick and he said, "Man, I got to go to the restroom." And we had a stopwatch and we timed the commercials. I think it was probably 2 minutes in between. He said, "Watch the stopwatch, and if it goes past two and I'm not back, just start talking." And I thought, well, okay, that sounds okay. I don't know what in the heck I'm going to say, but whatever you say, Mr. Don Newberg, I'll try to do. So now the clock's running, and I'm looking anxiously to see where the heck he is. And now the clock runs past 2 minutes, and still no Newberg. So I started talking. And now the guys are back on the court, and the game restarts. So I thought, I better keep talking. Where's Newberg? And so I did, and I got through most of the second quarter before he came back and sat down. And then it was halftime, and we went to a commercial, and he turned toward me, and he kind of smiled, and he said, "I really didn't have to go to the bathroom. I just wanted you to do some play-by-play." So that's how he threw me into the pool, and I paddled furiously and treaded water for a while, but I guess we got it done, and that's what launched the play-by-play. And I still think to this day he made me do the halftime interview and the totals at the end of the game, but that was okay.
Is broadcasting something that you always wanted to do, Denny?
Well, I don't know. That's a great question, but I don't think so, because when you're growing up and you're in high school and in college and you're playing sports, I think you're more interested, obviously, in playing. And I must say it was in the back of my mind. I remember going to St. Louis once a summer, and I always listen to the games. My dad was a Cardinal fan, so WJBC was a Cardinal affiliate, and we always had the games on in the house. And so I remember listening to the games and Jack Buck and Harry Carey, and I remember when we were down in St. Louis, I would always kind of look over my shoulder up into the press area where the broadcasters and the writers were, and just kind of looking for the guys who I was listening to or hearing. every night. So maybe there was a seed planted when I was still in grade school, and maybe 7, 8, 10 years old, somewhere in there. And it possibly was in the back of my mind. I was obviously more interested in watching the Cardinals and the game, whomever they were playing. And then, of course, I'd go home and I'd have the games on. My dad would have the games on in the house. But playing and not broadcasting at that point in your life is probably the priority.
That was Kansas City Royals broadcaster Denny Matthews with our Brian Bloodworth. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Illinois State's star running back Marshawn Coppridge ran into some trouble. Coach Brock Spack says Coppridge has been suspended indefinitely following his arrest on drug charges. Spack issued a statement saying he was disappointed the Coppridge is in this situation, but said, quote, "We will let the process continue before a final decision is made." Coppridge broke several school records during his All-American junior season, leading the Redbirds to the FCS championship game. Coppridge was arrested last week for allegedly trying to sell marijuana to an undercover agent in April. The former Allen Township fire chief has been indicted. WJBC's Terry James says he faces charges of felony theft and money laundering.
30-year-old Joshua Detterding is accused of stealing close to $27,000 from the fire district. The charges reportedly state he improperly deposited money into the district's petty cash fund for his own personal use, including the use of a fire district debit card at ATM machines in taverns. Detterding is being held on $1,500 bond. Terry James, WJBC and WJBC.com.
A former McLean County Sheriff's deputy fired for lying about an accident involving a squad car has been dismissed from his job as a part-time police officer in Hayworth. Sean O'Grady was hired by the Hayworth Police Department after he was let go by the McLean County Sheriff's Office for lying about details of a November 2013 wreck involving his parked squad car. O'Grady's vehicle was partially blocking a highway in rural Colfax when it was struck from behind by a pickup truck. The driver of the truck was ticketed for the crash, but those tickets were later rescinded. O'Grady was reportedly let go in the beginning of the year by the Hayworth Police Department after being placed on unpaid leave when criminal charges were filed against him last December. The local group that's looking to build a cooperative grocery store in Bloomington Normal took a big step this week by announcing a new location. 921 East Washington Street in Bloomington is the site for a proposed store. Greentop Grocery Outreach Manager Katie Novak says more than a dozen different locations were studied over the last year while trying to grow membership to raise money.
Total project cost is about $3.6 million. So we know that we need to make about 50% of that from our owners. Some of that comes from owner equity. So when folks become owners with us, their investment helps cover some of those costs.
Novak says the location is accessible to all types of transportation and has plenty of parking, plus is in a food desert. The group hopes to begin construction this fall and open sometime in the next 12 to 18 months. Governor Rauner says he's taking the right-to-work rejection in stride.
Difficult negotiations in government often involve political theater. That's a little bit of what that is.
House lawmakers have voted against the concept of allowing any workers the right to opt out of paying union dues, though the governor hasn't submitted a formal proposal. Rauner says this is all part of the negotiations. The fate of Jamie Snow is now in the hands of the 4th District Appellate Court in Springfield. Snow's appeal of his murder conviction in 2001 was heard this week. Snow's attorney argues that Danny Martinez was the prosecution's star witness, but his testimony can't be trusted because he couldn't identify Snow as the murderer until several years after the crime. Appellate prosecutor Anastasia Brooks says Martinez's testimony was only a small part of the state's case against Snow.
So really, Martinez's testimony really wasn't worth a whole lot. And it was actually Carlos Luna who did identify the defendant, at least in the element of the 1991 June lineup, that he was able to identify James Snow as the person who looked most like the person that Carlos Luna had seen from across the street.
Luna lived near the Clark Station where Billy Little was fatally shot on Easter Sunday, 1991.
There's no timetable for a ruling on Snow's appeal. Following a 7.8 magnitude earthquake that struck Nepal last month, killing more than 8,000 people, WJBC's Joe Ragusa reported from a candlelight vigil held by members of the Nepalese community in Bloomington Normal to honor the victims.
Deepak Sharma, an organizer of the vigil held at Uptown Circle, says the small group of Nepalese people in Bloomington Normal have heavy hearts.
This is more about sending a love and pray to the people of Nepal.
Around 8,000 people died last month, and another few dozen people died in a 7.3 magnitude earthquake on Tuesday. Govinda Bhandari says they're doing what they can here to help.
Here in Bloomington Normal, we are trying to, you know, work with the local community here and bring some solidarity for Nepal, something awareness or raise some money so we can help and support back home.
You can find out more about the local relief effort by visiting the Nepalese Association of Bloomington, Illinois Facebook page. In Uptown Normal, I'm Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Bloomington, Normal, and McLean County government leaders will hold their annual joint meeting at the ISU Alumni Center. Also Monday, Advocate Broman will break ground on a new $35 million integrated wellness center in Bloomington. On Thursday, six women will be named Women of Distinction at an annual banquet. On Friday, suspended Illinois State running back Marshawn Coppridge will make a court appearance on drug charges. Also Friday, James Carter of Normal faces sentencing on child pornography charges. He could get up to 120 years in prison. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.